as we did a couple of weeks ago, I'd love to pick up kind of where we left off with very much the thought that we'll be in and out of dialogue today, very much the same spirit. So I have some maybe just quick review and then dive into some new material today with plenty of time included for conversation.
Great.
Does that sound okay?
Good.
All right.
Yes.
All right, great. Well, since we met a couple weeks ago, I'll just review real briefly kind of where we went just to kind of get us all back on board and then dive into looking at some practical implications of what we talked about. As you'll recall, we reviewed just the basics of a developmental theory and actually kind of gave kind of a personal backdrop to it, which I think each one of us has around any of these theories. We talked about game-changing ideas across a lifetime and that developmental approaches to life certainly for me represents one of those really significant kind of a paradigm shift that's been with me now for some time. So we talked about it more personally, and then we moved into talking about some basic foundations of developmental theory. And you'll recall I talked a little bit about one of my professors in graduate school who had studied with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and she had trained him, then he trained us, that talking about stages is tricky, especially if we get too identified with the stages or the theory and forget the person, because none of us really is a stage. And so kind of gave that as a backdrop to then moving into talking specifically about moral development. And the two big names in moral development theory are Lawrence Kohlberg and his student Carol Gilligan, both of whom were at Harvard together for a number of years, and then she's moved on from there. But we talked about three different larger stages, and then inside these larger stages, it's been broken down into sub-stages. But we talked about pre-conventional morality, which is based on, basically whatever I can get away with. We talked about expediency. Conventional morality, which has to do with conforming to the group and to rules and codes. And then we talked about post-conventional morality, which is looking much more at, thinking of Carol Gilligan's research, looking much more at caring and connection as the basis for morality over the previous stage of conventional morality, which tends to focus more on principles and laws, regulations, and so on. And that's kind of where we wrapped up. So it was an introduction to developmental theory, specifically moral developmental theory. And rather than hurrying the presentation, I appreciated very much our dialogue during that presentation. We decided to wait till today to continue the second part. And this is the part that for me is really of interest and really germane to the work we're doing here at Integral Recovery Institute. So before I dive into looking at how developmental stage theory applies to working in and around addiction and recovery, let me just check in with you guys to see, do you have any questions from before or any thoughts before we kind of move forward? Victoria, Hamlet?
I'm okay.
I'm fine, ready to move on to the next.
Okay, good. And Victoria, how's the fidelity, the sound?
It's fine, Bob. Yes, I'm doing fine with that.
Okay, good. All right, well then let's dive into looking at some practical implications of developmental theory, especially as applied to integral recovery. I'll be stressing this throughout the conversation today, but I think there are some back up for just a second. I've been reading Gary Nixon, who's written about three different stages of addiction recovery. In fact, I've got two of his articles sitting right beside me here, both of which apply Wilbur's integral theory to looking at different needs across the process of moving into recovery, from the first stage, which is literal abstinence, you're just focusing on kind of one day at a time getting off of the substance or whatever the addictive behavior is. And then the second stage he refers to as really kind of dropping another level. And this is where you really begin to address the psychological and relational aspects that were the foundation psychologically and spiritually to the addiction. And so once one is off of the drug, and it can take as long as it can take sometimes a few months to a year or two to get really significantly back to what one psychiatrist I worked with, he called it your birthday brain, your brain before it was affected by alcohol and other drugs, that one can even work on stage two recovery. And I'll speak a little bit more into that today. And then finally, Gary Nixon discusses stage three recovery, which is really into the kind of the higher domains of Wilbur's model, which are really looking at spirituality, spiritual consciousness, non-dual awareness. This would be the application of meditative states and stages and so on. At any rate, I think that being able to understand a couple of different theories, like developmental theory, can really help an individual in recovery from addiction across all three of those stages. And one of the things I'd like to do over these next few minutes is kind of spell out what that might look like. So to begin with, a developmental model like what we've been talking about with Kohlberg, I think it can really be helpful not only to the caregiver or the treatment provider. If you're doing counseling or some form of treatment with somebody who's in recovery, it can be very helpful to you as the provider to understand and keep clear about what happens developmentally in and around addiction. But I think it can be as helpful and even more so with the addict, him or herself, to help them understand that what goes hand in hand with addiction is a kind of regression developmentally back to an earlier or more primitive or less sophisticated stage of development, and that goes hand in hand with the addiction, which is part of what helps us understand the atrocious things we've said and done in and around addiction. So that's part of why I think understanding developmental theory can be helpful to the addict. But secondly, I think it also can be hopeful insofar as it points the direction of where the addict might recover to. This idea of recovery, what are we recovering? Well, hopefully we're recovering where we were before the addiction began, and or moving beyond where we were before. So I think developmental theory helps us understand kind of the places to which we descend, as well as gives us kind of a roadmap for where we might be headed. And I wanted to ground this a little bit by sharing with you all some of the work that I've been doing in the last couple of years, just to kind of put some flesh on the bones of developmental theory. And then we can stop and talk a little bit about that, see how it makes sense to you all, and also maybe what you've been thinking and doing. My work over the last couple of years has been primarily addressing what Nixon calls stage one recovery. And specifically what I've been looking at are what are the biggest barriers to people getting into treatment coming out of addiction in the earliest stages, where they're still at least highly ambivalent about stopping the use of whatever substance. And from a psychological perspective, the two biggest barriers that consistently come up in the literature are personal shame and cultural stigma. And those are really kind of two sides of one coin, because I don't know how this has gone for you in your own personal experiences or with those that you've loved, but I can really relate to this personally in terms of my own recovery process, is that personal shame, which makes me feel awful about myself for having been addicted, is ironically and sadly one of the things that keeps me from getting into treatment, because I feel so badly about acknowledging that I've got such a big problem. And I said it's the flip side of a coin, because the other side is that in our culture, in most cultures, to be addicted is to be somehow weak or defective or bad. And in fact, it's those cultural attitudes, familial and cultural attitudes that we grow up in, which, by the way, aren't, it's not that they're not applicable, it's just that they can be crippling. When I take those attitudes in, that's really what psychology is now calling shame. It's now calling shame self-stigmatization. In other words, when I take in stigmatizing attitudes from around myself and those become my internal world, then that manifests as what John Bradshaw calls toxic shame. And so since shame is such a huge barrier to treatment and to recovery, I've been curious about what could be done to help reduce shame. And the one angle that I've taken, and this has constituted most of my work over the last couple of years, has been exploring the neuroscience of addiction, looking at addiction in the brain. And first of all, getting as clear as I can, in as simple as a way as I can, of what goes on inside of our nervous systems around alcohol and drug abuse and addiction. And then secondly, how might we communicate that in a way that makes sense, that's able to be understood by our clients and ourselves? And so this has been my work, my writing and my speaking. I've done a lot of training around this. And the main beneficiary has been myself, because I've learned a lot, and I've learned it's getting simpler and simpler and simpler. I'm giving a presentation in October in Las Vegas at a conference on behavioral addictions, and I'm going to be presenting on this topic of the neuroscience of addiction, and I've got it down to 12 facts that you should know about the brain and addiction. So I've got it down to 12 things now, and maybe I'll cut that in half over time. But so that's the work I've been doing to help people with shame and stigma. is really trying to understand from a brain perspective what happens to the brain, specifically where our brain is hijacked by the substance or by the addiction, and that we're reduced to lower and lower levels of development, including moral development. And then to add to that, the next piece that I've been working on, which is my partner Colleen and I have been working for the last year or so on developing an approach to looking at what Wilbur would say would be the lower left-hand quadrant, namely the relationship domain. And how do you go about, as a facilitator of healing, how do you go about helping a couple or a family member restore trust when it's been broken so rapidly in relationship? And that the same material that I've been presenting to individuals in terms of addiction in the brain, understanding how it is that we regress to lower levels of moral development, this would be helping to explain to not only the addict in recovery, but also his or her significant others. This could be a spouse, a partner, a family member, a friend, a work colleague. And so this work has moved Colleen and I into looking at doing the same thing, as addressing shame and stigma that go on in relationships where the individual feels ashamed for what he or she's done. And let's say that their partner feels horrible hurt, betrayal of trust, anger, resentment, and judgment. How do we help couples? How do we help? That's been really our focus, is working with couples. How do we help couples to repair what psychology calls attachment injuries, basically huge breaches of trust. And this would be looking at what Nixon calls stage two recovery, where you're dropping below. This isn't really possible while the person is still getting off of drugs and getting stabilized, but maybe 6 months or a year later that you can begin to really go into looking at what's going on within relationships that may have been part of triggering addiction, as well as how do you go about healing relationships. I guess I should mention one point here is that the number one trigger for relapse is relationship stress. Most people relapse because of stress, and most people's stress is located primarily in their central relationships. It has to do with the way that we're wired around our attachment systems, but it seems important then to address what's going on in the relationship if the person's going to sustain sobriety. And this is kind of the work that, that Colleen and I have been doing. So in either case, it seems like to me that, that the work that I've been doing, the teaching about the brain and addiction is important. And I also think that teaching about stage theory, stage development in the recovery process can also be a very powerful kind of medicine or antidote for shame and judgment, helping people to understand what happens psychologically around their moral capacity in and around addiction can help reduce the shame. And I'll differentiate in a few minutes between shame and guilt, because this isn't about excusing things. It's just about trying to find a different approach than the person just going into the sinkhole of feeling 100% bad about themselves as a person. My experience has been that it's been fairly easy for clients that I've worked with, and Colleen as well, to understand how their addiction has taken them down. In the way that we talked about a couple weeks ago, that that first stage of development morally, what Kohlberg called pre-conventional development, is totally egocentric, totally self-centered, where in that state of mind, I know that for me, nothing really mattered to me except getting high, except getting whatever the substance was that I was addicted to. And it's typically not that difficult for clients to understand that that's where they ended up going to, where everybody in the addict's life, everybody becomes basically an object. The Jewish theologian Martin Buber made a distinction between what he called I-thou relationships, I-thou, versus what he called I-it relationships. And an I-thou relationship is where I treat you as sacred. I treat you as an individual. An I-it relationship is where I reduce you down to being just an object. And you're an object that I'm going to manipulate or utilize for my own purposes. And this is really the moral stage, this I-it stage, this pre-conventional or egocentric stage, is the stage that's in common across virtually all addiction. In this stage, there's no capacity for being able to take the perspective of the other, no capacity for certainly no capacity for compassion. Again, most addicts that I've known, myself, I can clearly see the truth in looking at this description of where I ended up morally. Let me pause there for just a second and just check in with you all and see how we're doing so far.
No, I'm doing great. This is very interesting.
Does this make sense so far?
Oh, absolutely, and certainly resonates with my experience as well.
Okay, good, good. Most of this, I should say, is written from the first person. You know, it's like one of those things where I studied much of this theory 10, 20, 30 years ago and then proceeded to live it out. Very, talk about humble pie, but it's like it's very helpful for me to help understand kind of how things develop. I think also, Victoria and Hamlet, it helps me to sometimes to have a map of what happened, even though what happened may be atrocious. It helps me to see it more objectively and be less sunk by it, less buried by shame, just to have an understanding, oh, this is what happened. And for example, in my studies of addiction in the brain, and this is why this happened. Again, it's not to excuse myself, but it really helps to be able to kind of step back and look at the cycle of addiction and the impact that it has on the brain. I remember years ago a conversation with a friend of mine who's a psychologist who we went to graduate school together, and he's a very good friend.
Hello, are you there?
Are you still there?
I'm here.
Let's see. I think John was trying to call in. He tends to call in on the wrong Skype, and I think Bob must have answered his call, and therefore we lost Bob. Let me shoot. That was
Victoria.
Oh,
Victoria.
Bob, are you still there? Good. Did you answer John by mistake?
I didn't do it by mistake. I did it on purpose.
Oh, because we lose you when you do that.
I thought I probably needed to get him in here. So that was my mistake. Are we still here, Victoria Hamlin? Are we still here?
I'm on. Yeah.
I'm here.
Sorry
yes.
about that.
I'll call John to tell him what to do.
Okay. Okay, I think we're back again. So sorry for that, you guys. I think I went to a post-conventional stage of morality and answered, even though wisdom would have said not to do that. Sorry about that. Well, I got a little bit sidetracked there. Sorry about that. I went into kind of a Skype panic, so I'm back again. Anyway, I feel like that it's been helpful for me to have kind of a more objective view of how this stuff all goes. And I was talking about my friend who said to me that, you know, he was doing some reading about, I think it was morning glory seeds, a hallucinogen, and he said that he had read one of the authors in that field that said that if you take enough of these, it doesn't matter where or who you are on the planet, if you take enough of these, you will have this experience, whatever the experience was. And I kind of feel that around addiction is that if you go deep enough into addiction, it's kind of a grand leveler, and it will reduce any of us, no matter how morally upright you might have been before the addiction, it will reduce us down to this pre-conventional, very self-centered morality that we may have all begun life in, but we may not have visited it all that much until the addiction really kicks in. So for me, it really helps to get the lay of the land, and I hope that it can be helpful to you too. And I definitely have found it helpful with families I work with. In fact, let me tell you an example of a family that I just saw a weekend before last. I met with a family up in Los Angeles where the family members are dealing with a father who's actively alcoholic, and it's actually complicated by a dementia process. And this is a father, an individual who is extremely bright, historically made a lot of fame and fortune owing to his intellect, and that's sadly really deteriorating rapidly owing to Alzheimer's, coupled with lifelong alcoholism. And sitting with the family and helping them to understand what happens with either one of these disease processes alone, whether it be the alcohol addiction or the dementia process owing to Alzheimer's, just talking into with adult children of this father as well as his wife of over 50 years, talking into what happens to the brain under the influence of these two diseases and how it's while it's extremely painful, beyond words painful, how it's understandable what's going on in terms of things that he says and does that are from this lowest level of moral development. And it's been an ongoing conversation with them, but I have to tell you that being able to talk the way we're talking right now with them, it really took. You could feel it. They were going, oh, so we need to stop looking at Dad as just being a pain in the butt. You know, we need to stop looking at Dad as not trying hard enough. And again, it's not about letting their father off the hook, but it's helping them to understand that the combination of his particular presenting problems, they're almost guaranteed to lead to a regression in moral development. And the goal, of course, is to address the alcoholism definitively and do what we can to stave off the advances of the dementia. But it part of what they can do is help themselves by having a bit better of a perspective on what's going on, so that they're not sending darts of hatred towards their father every time they interact with them. So that would be just one example recently of a practical application of what we're talking about. And you can certainly take that and apply it to working with addicts in recovery of any stripe. Any comments, questions before we kind of proceed forward, Victoria and Hamlet?
Nope, I'm very much with you, Bob.
Thanks, Hamlet. Thank you. You too? You good, Victoria?
Yes, yes.
Okay. We talked about how it can be helpful for addicts to see themselves for where they've gone. But I also mentioned it's just as important that addicts in recovery have a vision for their more central or authentic values. And what you can find in moral development theory, beyond just looking at pre-conventional morality, is that conventional morality conventional morality is kind of a synonym for ethnocentric morality. This is kind of us against them. This is where we conform to group rules and so on. But that's a stage up or a step up from egocentric or pre-conventional morality. Sorry for the terminology. I hope this isn't too confusing. But beyond conventional morality is post-conventional morality. And this is where you get into the higher levels of morality that Wilbur and others talk about. For example, world-centric moral values and even what Wilbur calls cosmocentric values. These are post-conventional, or some would say even post-conventional moral values. This points a finger in the direction of where the addict ideally wants to relocate. And so I think it can be inspiring as well. On the more shadow end of things, as the addict begins to detox and clear their body out of the chemicals, this is the first chance there is to begin to face some of the emotions that were buried by the addiction. And maybe all three of us can relate to this. I certainly can personally, is that once the cloud lifted in terms of my addiction was to alcohol and to prescription medications, once that lifted, and it took several months for me to really begin to get kind of my feet back on the ground, in terms of my brain's functioning, then what follows is the reward for abstinence is now you get to feel sadness and anger and regret and a huge barrels full of remorse. And I say that tongue-in-cheek because that really is the next piece of work, is beginning to deal with all the feelings that well up. For me, owing to the fact that I had a sponsor and was working in a 12-step program, this for me really centered around moving into working on steps 4 and 5, addressing all of these feelings that had been buried. Step 4 says, you know, where we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I underlined in my notes for our conversation this morning, it's a moral inventory, and this is part of the relevance of understanding, I think, moral developmental theory, because it ties right into what it is that needs to be addressed along the way if recovery is really going to take hold, especially according to the 12 steps. Any 12-step approach really addresses, first of all, doing I can still remember page after page after page of moral inventory with all of those columns addressing so many different individuals and so many different things that I had said or done or not done, and doing it just an exhaustive. It took me a few months to complete my moral inventory. It was very, very necessary and very excruciating for me. And then to move into step five, which, you know, in AA says that we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. For me, this meant sitting with my sponsor week after week, going through these cataloging of pre-conventional moral behaviors, basically. The process of beginning to move from pre-conventional to conventional, at least according to the 12-step program. And also I want to say I went back and reviewed yesterday John's book on integral recovery and his integral 12 steps. I really like them a lot. I'm not going to quote those today, but they apply very richly here. I also want to mention that early in my recovery I was involved in Against the Stream. It's a Buddhist fellowship here in the Los Angeles area. It's organized by Noah Levine. And we had, we called it Refuge Recovery. We had our own version of working through a moral inventory. So whatever the entry point is, Smart Recovery has its own approach. That all of them involve coming to grips with where we ended up regressing to, namely that pre-conventional stage of morality, and beginning to see the connection, and this is the part that's really redemptive, I think, is beginning to see the connection between these so-called moral failings, they're not so-called, they are moral failings, to see the connection between them and the addiction. In other words, to realize not only what we've done, but why we could have descended to that level. I think the why is really important. It was for me is as I began to understand that things that I did were a function of the addiction process and that addiction process is well nigh universal, I could begin to experience some grace, which the grace permitted me to move forward. If I'd been buried by shame, I would have stayed stuck. And this, as I mentioned earlier, is the single greatest impediment to most people continuing to move through recovery, is the enormous amount of shame that we can experience inside and then from the outside in terms of stigma. And so working the steps was very significant to me in terms of not only realizing what I had done, but why I had done it, beginning to understand the effects of addiction. Also, working then held out hope that maybe I could restore myself or recover what it is that I feel more capable of, is that much of my life has been characterized by caring behaviors. And there's a lengthy period in the middle of my life in and around addiction that is the opposite of that. And it felt like to me to have some kind of roadmap was very helpful. I want to talk just a little bit about how it is that if you're working with in and around addiction, and you can reflect on this, we can reflect on this ourselves. I want to talk just a little bit about how it is that somebody who's extending care or treatment to somebody in addiction in the earliest stage one recovery, how do you talk to somebody who's at a pre-conventional level of morality about recovery, and how does that then develop across stages of recovery as a person goes deeper into recovery? How do those explanations perhaps need to change in order to have traction? And I think I'll just talk about this, if it's okay with you all, in terms of my own experience. My personal experience coming out of addiction, as well as my clinical experience working with people who are themselves moving into recovery. In earliest recovery, the appeal for sobriety pr- probably has its most leverage in and around appealing to the I want to say the egocentric level of morality, which if you continue to use, you will die. In other words, if you're not really talking about the impact of other people yet, because that requires a higher stage of moral development. It doesn't make much sense to talk about that when you have somebody who's locked into pre-conventional addiction. My own experience was I was in the hospital detoxing, and there was a good psychiatrist, an addictionologist, down here in Los Angeles, Dr. Reitman. I so appreciate him. He came in and he taught a class on addiction and the brain, and talked about it in terms of what we do to our brain in and around alcohol and drug addiction. And the upshot message that I got from this, it was a series of classes in the hospital, was that if I continue to do this, I'm going to die. And that message got through. In fact, there was a lot that was being offered in the hospital that was at the wrong level for me. We went out to a number of AA meetings, and we had speakers come in, and we had nursing staff and so on, talking from what I look at now as being more of a conventional stage of morality, and that really didn't communicate nearly as powerfully to me as did communicating at this more basic. To put it in the terms of Abraham Maslow, it's just talking about physical survival, that first level of physiological survival. We're not even yet at the level of talking about caring about others. It's about survival and just being able to be secure inside our own skin. But soon enough, things began to change for me. I mentioned earlier that I came out of the hospital and immediately got involved in the Against the Stream Fellowship in Santa Monica down here, which was, as I mentioned earlier, a Buddhist approach to the 12-step program. And had a chance there to take several workshops with Noah Levine, Kevin Griffin, George Haas. And so we were practicing mindfulness meditation as well as beginning to talk about the impact of addiction on our relationships. And I'd go to meetings several times a week that were really focused on looking at the impact that addiction had had on our lives, our work lives, our relationship lives, our love relationships. As well as at this time, I began working with my AA sponsor, Mick, and that also reinforced, I think, kind of this next stage, which would be the conventional or more ethnocentric moral level. At this level, the message I was getting was no longer that I'm going to die, although that was always in the background. The message that I felt ready for at this point is, this isn't just about me and my physical survival, it's about how this has affected my relationship with my partner and with my daughter, and how it's negatively impacted my work, and owing to the work I do, it's not okay for me to be half there, et cetera. And so as I moved from, I think, a more pre-conventional center of gravity to more moving towards the conventional, there was a different message that I needed, and it was supplied to me in different forms, including the Buddhist fellowship I was involved in, as well as started going to AA meetings. It was quite a shift for me, and I look back on it in hindsight, from those early months of recovery to a transition that took a good year or so, I think, for me probably, that I moved from a place where my thought was that I can still remember being so angry about people telling me what to do. This is none of your business. This is my life. I can do whatever I want. I can still remember that early on, to a gradual melting of that kind of I want to call it narcissism, where I just felt like I was an island unto myself, and really beginning to be open to what others had to say to me, as well as to be open to others in terms of what I had said and done at the worst of my addiction. I guess I want to make a point here is that there's a shift here from my being early on horribly ashamed. Well, at the beginning, I wasn't ashamed of anything. I was just angry. And then I moved into a sense of shame. But I think as I began to understand both from my involvement in the various programs I just mentioned, but also by beginning to read more about addiction and what goes on in the frontal cortex with addiction is that it's basically shut down and it's overwhelmed by the impulsive emotional centers of the brain, the limbic system. And as I began to understand that my brain was basically hijacked during addiction, it helped me to understand what I had done. And also, as I understood the implications, I think, of what we're talking about, moral stages of development, it helped me to understand what I had regressed to, and at the stage that I regressed to, that I could overcome. In other words, I could progress back to a higher stage of moral development given sobriety, and that what I had done didn't define me. That's kind of what shame is that shame is where we look at our various atrocious behaviors and those define who we are, and who can live with the burden of that? I couldn't. And certainly it's very, very difficult to grieve. What did Carl Jung say? To drink one's bitter cup of wrath. To drink one's bitter cup of wrath, to really drink one's sorrow, one's grief, is so painful and difficult for me. But then eventually,
would you say that again? I missed what Jung said.
Yes. He said, the phrase he had was, to drink one's bitter cup of wrath.
Okay, thank you.
It's one of those really poignant images to me. I'll tell you something, Victoria, how interesting it goes. I've been in Jungian analysis for years, locally with Don Slaggy, and his analyst was Ed Ettinger, and Ed Ettinger studied under Jung. So that's
wow.
The story's related down to the generations, and so I don't know that that's even in any book, but that's Jung as filtered through Ed Ettinger as filtered through Don Slaggy. You know how it goes sometimes. But that image is one of those really pregnant images that's always stuck with me. And so I think that the move from toxic shame, Victoria, from toxic shame towards what I think of as a healthy guilt is something about drinking one's bitter cup of wrath. And that's only possible to me if I really understand the addiction process as something separate than my deepest identity. In other words, I think this is one of the values of looking at addiction as a brain disease. I think there's lots of different metaphors for addiction, but one powerful benefit, I think, of understanding at the least addiction as a brain disease is that it helps me to externalize the disease process from my identity as Bob Weathers, or yours as Victoria, or yours as Hamlet. And one author, one psychoanalyst here in Los Angeles, Robert Stolarow, talks about this as decentering, the ability to decenter, which is the ability to step outside of whatever we've been identified with. In this case, the awful things that we've done from this pre-conventional level of morality, and to be able to step back and look at it objectively and own it. It's not about disowning it. That would be where healthy guilt comes in, is that I should feel bad. I should feel guilty. But that does not make me, an evil person that did these things, and certainly as a function of the addiction, and that healing and transformation are possible. It's impossible when we're ashamed to really reach out for help, to reach out for transformation and healing, because why would we do that? We're just 100% awful and defective and bad. So I believe the upshot of this is I believe that information, not only about the brain and addiction, but also about moral stages, really can help and does help to reduce shame in our clients, in ourselves, and makes it possible then for us to drink our bitter cup of wrath. That is, it makes it possible for us then to begin the next stage of work, which I look at as stage two and even stage three recovery, a la Gary Nixon. It helps us to be able to focus on accepting what is really our rightful responsibility, call it healthy guilt, let's say, as well as to make genuine amends, which, you know, in the 12-step program, steps 7 and 8 follow right on steps 4 and 5, it seems like to me, in terms of it's only when I've been able to take a moral inventory and share that that I can dig deeper now and begin to bridge over into reaching out to others that I've wronged. And I think it's impossible to do that if I'm sunk by shame. And so I think if I can understand how I got to where I did, where it was that I landed, let's say pre-conventional morality, why it is that that happened, and I think about that in terms of the hijacking of the moral centers of the brain. The moral compass of the brain is located in the orbital frontal cortex. To be technical, it's right behind our eyes and our brain. And that's overridden by the survival-based drives of addiction, which are coming out of our the pleasure center of our brain, located more in the middle of our brain. And once that takes over, you can forget about making any kind of moral decisions beyond just purely selfish and survival-oriented. And so I think it helps to have this information in hand. I think I want to pause there, check in with you guys. I want to open it up. We can kind of take it different directions now, but let me just check in. How does this land? Any thoughts you have, reactions, personal revelations?
Well, I think one of the things that was extremely helpful to me in the early days of this recovery period while working with a therapist, Bob, like you, he also was very good at helping me to understand the damage that had been caused to my brain. And I was able to look at my addiction as something that was going on within my head. It wasn't really going on within me. Like, you know, it helped me to identify less with it and be able to look, okay, I got these crisscross wires. I have this faulty computer program going on, and it's making me think certain things, and it's making me feel certain things. You know, I got these crisscross wires. So I was able to not identify as much and relate to my disease in a completely different way. Whereas before, it was, I had no idea what was going on. This was me. This is how I acted out. This is how I felt. This is how I, you know, obsessed and compulsed over these things. But now I'm like, okay, I understand what's going on. And it was very, very helpful in the early days. And as far as the drive too, I mean, mine wasn't afraid to die, although mine was also very ego-centered, I guess. Mine was, I wasn't afraid to die, although my, I guess people near me would have suffered a loss. My fear was living out the rest, the next 30, 40 years of my life in absolute misery. Yeah. Because hey, I felt dying was going to come quickly. To die of an overdose, that would be quick. Yeah. But my fear was looking around going, do I want the next 30 years to be like this? I mean, screw what everybody, what I had done to anybody else. I just didn't want to keep living this way.
Yeah.
You know, waking up, being 70 years old, waking up and I'm still caught in the same behavior patterns.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Hamlet. You know, I'm going to chew on that all day long, what you just shared. I want to go back and review my own experience, especially early on. It makes a lot of sense to me. And I'm wondering, that's another piece that I focus less on. It would be good for me to think of that. Just, what's it going to be like to be in this state of mind for the next 30 or 40 years? That really resonates for me too. And as you're saying, it's a perfect, another perfect expression of this earlier stage of moral development to which you were reduced. That preconditional morality is really concerned about my physical survival, as the example I gave, or my misery. You know, it's not about what's causing other people necessarily, is what it feels like to me. Or if it is causing problems for other people, it's the misery that it causes me to be around people that are miserable or whatever. You know? Because all roads lead to me. So, yeah, that's very helpful. Yeah. And thank you also for your example of working with a therapist who was attuned. I had a supervisor here in Los Angeles for several years. She actually moved up to Portland, Oregon, and I continued in supervision with her by phone. Her name is Bonnie Badenoch, and she's got a book. She's got a couple of books called, one of them is called Being a Brainwise Therapist, and then she has a workbook that goes along with it. And Bonnie studied under Dan Siegel and Alan Shore here in Los Angeles, who are both very much involved in looking at the neuroscience of relationships and of therapy. And Bonnie really helped for me, helped me to connect the dots around my addiction and what's going on in the brain. And she did it in a way that her, one of Bonnie's goals is to train psychotherapists all over the country, actually all over the world, in being more aware of what's going on in the brain so that they can talk about it, not technically, but very, I mean, not much more technically than the way that we're talking today about it, where you're sitting with a client and if you can talk about it like your therapist talked with you, Hamlet.
Right.
If you can talk about it that way with the client where they can understand it, it can be very useful. And I experienced that firsthand in supervision, first with Bonnie, and then in my own work with clients, realizing this is really important information to have and be technical. In fact, if it's too technical, it doesn't make any sense to even share it. So I'm working on, what do they call it, the dummies guide, is that what they, oh, the idiot's guide, the idiot's guide to addiction in the brain. Yeah, it's great meeting with you, Hamlet, and you too, Victoria.
Thank you, Bob. This is extremely helpful. Both
well,
of these lessons have been.
Thank you,
so,
both.
Thank you.
Both. Yeah, we'll be in touch again soon, okay? And we'll definitely pick up on this in one of our next lectures. Both of you be well, and we'll talk again soon, okay?
Thank you.
Sounds great.
Bye.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, all.
Bye.